Fry's English Delight. And this week, Stephen Fry tackles the perennially provocative subject of language and class.
The scene, Verdun. Private Higgins is dying in his commanding officer's arms.
Oh, sir, take me messages to me folks, dear old lady, sir. I say, Higgins, there's a good chap, man, don't talk. Oh, sir, cough, please would you take me messages to me folks in dear old bloody, sir. Oh, Higgins, there's a good chap. Don't talk, man, don't talk. Oh, but, sir, what about me messages? Higgins, don't talk, man. Why, sir? Because you're so common.
Politically incorrect joke courtesy of actor Nigel Pegram. And straight away, we're in the realm of assumptions about status and pretension and supposed superiority and presumed inferiority too, all just because of the way we speak. It's almost 100 years since George Bernard Shaw wrote that no Englishman could open his mouth without another despising him. But it still seems almost impossible to talk about language as an indicator of social class in the United Kingdom without somebody else assuming all kinds of prejudices are being aired, validated even, and reaching forthwith for the large bottle marked Umbridge. Yes, that's just under the one labelled Outrage. The two are often confused. Not that I am in any position to pretend any natural identification with the lower orders, sounding as I do. It's obvious that mine is the unmistakable voice of a toff. But I didn't always sound like this. No, I used to sound a lot posher.
Stephen has been animadverting about the love-hate relationship which seems to exist between those two countries.
At the average party, tickets are sold for a place in the queue to talk to the American. Not because Americans are more than ordinarily intelligent, attractive or fascinating, but because they know instinctively the right way to an Anglo-Saxon's heart. The one thing all English people want to hear from Americans is that they have a marvellous accent, and it's the one thing most Americans are prepared to tell them.
Oh, good Lord, was that really me? Well, that was what I sounded like about 30 years ago, somewhat more refined than what I am now. A rare recording of a programme I took part in around 1983, a late-night talk show hosted by Ned Sherrin, a man whose own speech had made that journey in reverse during his lifetime. I suppose the goal then was RP, Received Pronunciation, the quintessential sound of the BBC in years gone by. But for my generation and upbringing, the voice trajectory has been relentlessly downwards. And I'm not the only one whose speech delivery has been levelled out during that period. Think of how much Mrs. Thatcher's voice changed. Think of Her Majesty the Queen. Think how Tony Blair would adjust his speech to curry favour with the hoi polloi. His appearance with Catherine Tate is a perhaps extreme but telling example.
Look at my face.
Right, what are you doing?
Is my face bothered?
No, wait a minute.
Does my face look bothered, though?
No, are you messing with my mind?
Face bothered. Top shot, centre parts, trainers, small feet.
Does it mean we aren't bothered by class issues anymore? Or that it's all just a lot more subtle? Well, it's time to bring in someone who knows whereof they speak. Dr. Julia Snell is a lecturer in sociolinguistics at King's College London. So, Julie, is there actually any hard evidence that we still judge each other by the way we speak? I mean, obviously, regionally is one thing, but by the choice of words and expressions in terms of class?
Absolutely. What we find is that when people evaluate ways of speaking, these are social rather than linguistic judgments. So people are actually evaluating the imagined speakers of those varieties rather than the linguistic properties of the speech itself. And this is very much linked to social class. So one of the key findings of language attitudes research is that non-standard varieties of English, and in particular urban vernaculars like Glaswegian and Brummie, and ethnically marked varieties, these are consistently rated low for traits like intelligence, competence, confidence, leadership. And this, of course, is because ratings along these dimensions reflect the dominant social status of the so-called superior groups in society who tend to speak standard English with an RP accent.
Yes, we always need someone to look down on, as
Absolutely.
It were. So there are people looking down on the only way is Essex, or they're looking down on the way gypsies dress for marriages, or whatever it is. There's a slightly unpleasant taint of snobbery in a lot of reality television, isn't there?
there is. And this is linked, of course, to the cultural stereotype of the chav as well. Yeah. So in Britain, we may not always talk in terms of social class, but we're quite good at finding other terms to talk about it. So if you take the stereotype of the chav, this has been exaggerated for comedic purposes. So the character of Vicky Pollard in Little Britain, for example. Yeah. And language is very much part of this social stereotype. So Vicky's language exaggerates the kinds of characteristics that we think are common to working class teenagers' speech. So Vicky's language is permeated with what we call discourse markers, things like yeah, right, but, like, anyway, which don't appear to add anything to the referential content of the speech.
What the Germans call Flickwort, little flick words.
Absolutely, yeah. Which actually do quite important work in real language, but which are made to seem inarticulate and incoherent. Her language uses lots of non-standard grammatical features and so on. So if we take actual research into teenagers' speech, this isn't really how they speak, but the perception that this is the case leads to these kinds of comedic exaggerations.
Thank you. I might want to come back to you in just a few moments, Julia, if I may, but before that, you and non-you. A familiar expression to many, but new to most people under the age of about 40, I'd reckon. There was a famous essay which crystallised the whole debate about class and language, which Nancy Mitford later took up, and we have lived with the great you and non-you divide ever since. That original essay by linguist Alan Ross appeared in 1954, and echoes of it still reverberate. There was a very famous list of word variants, one set very you or upper, the other not the kind of things the upper classes would use at all, very non-you. For instance, it was non-you to say
serviette.
You to use
table napkin.
Spectacles.
Glasses.
Toilet.
Lavatory.
Rich.
Wealthy.
Pudding.
Sweet.
Mirror.
Looking glass.
Radio.
Wireless.
But it was also a matter of pronunciation.
Just.
Jest.
Catch.
Kitch.
Really?
Really.
Tire.
Tar.
Lion.
Lawn.
Forehead.
Forehead.
Handkerchief.
Handkerchief.
Ride.
Raid.
Pretentious, perhaps? A little affected? Worth remembering that some philologists believe raid is how Shakespeare would have pronounced R-I-D-E, though, so we shouldn't perhaps be too quick to mock or mork. Expressions were also thought something of a giveaway.
They've a lovely home.
They've a very nice house.
And what one did in there is important. The bathroom is the place.
To take a bath.
Distinctly non-you. Whereas
to have one's bath
would be the you thing. Manners, of course, are a minefield.
Pleased to meet you.
Was viewed as a frequent non-you response to the greeting
how do you do?
You speakers were expected just to repeat the greeting.
How do you do?
And to reply to the greeting
how do you do?
With
quite well, thank you.
Was definitely non-you. You speakers ate, or ate
lunch.
In the middle of the day. Luncheon was seen as old-fashioned you even then, and
dinner?
In the evening. If a you speaker felt that what was being eaten was a travesty of a dinner, it may appropriately have been referred to as
supper.
Non-you speakers, on the other hand, had their
dinner
in the middle of the day, along with children and dogs. The interesting thing about examining that controversy today is that then it was accepted that the lower classes may have tried to emulate their betters' pronunciations and deliveries, but the unspoken assumption was that this would almost always be a failure, the hyacinth bucket syndrome, and there was hardly a hint of a suggestion of a scintilla of a possibility that the upper orders might try to imitate the lower ones. And that, as we have heard, is not the case today. Sociolinguist Julia Snell again. So, Julia, is there such a thing, if you are British English, as sounding classless?
I'm not sure that there is a classless voice. I mean, we talk about, or people, especially in the media, have spoken about estuary English, and the idea that this is somehow takes up the middle ground between Cockney on the one hand and received pronunciation on the other. But actually, some of the features of estuary English, things like glottal stops, these are actually features that we might associate with a modern RP, As a linguist, what I like to do is describe what's going on in the language rather than necessarily prescribe how people should behave linguistically.
Yes, it's a strange thing, but with language, somehow, there will always be people who believe there is a right and a wrong. And no matter how many professors, no matter how many lexicographers, no matter how many linguists and philologists they listen to whose profession and passion, like mine, is language, telling them there is no right and wrong, they'll always say, yes, there jolly well is, and they'll write books about it.
Well, we live in a standard language culture, and where virtually everyone subscribes to the idea of correctness. Yeah. So one linguistic form is right, another is wrong. People believe this is just common sense, that it's an inherent part of language. Of course it isn't. As speakers, we confer prestige onto linguistic varieties.
Yes.
And we tend to confer prestige onto those varieties considered to be associated with the higher social classes.
And has the wheel come full circle now? Should I, if I wanted myself to be more successful as a broadcaster, should I, like Tony Blair or David Cameron, should I soften the slightly obvious public school articulations that come out of my mouth and sort of, look, now, listen, come on, you know, sort of a little bit more like that, those glottal stops that Tony Blair was fond of doing. Should I do that?
Well, I think you're right that received pronunciation is perhaps evaluated slightly differently today. So it has kind of negative connotations to do with elitism, exclusiveness, inaccessibility, which therefore some people modify the way they talk. And you mentioned Tony Blair, for example. So a politician can now modify their accent. They can throw in a few glottal stops in order to try and convince the electorate that actually they're not very upper class, they're really just one of us, and therefore they can talk on our behalf. But the public are pretty savvy, and often they will pick up on these performances and negatively evaluate them as inauthentic. So it's a very fine line to walk, I think. And I think perhaps if you started talking like that, Stephen, the public would smell a rat.
I think they probably would. So the new hierarchies might not exactly resemble the old ones, but the new ones exist nonetheless. Victoria Mather writes the social stereotypes column in the Daily Telegraph, which neatly skewers the speech patterns of all kinds of social groups. Actually, her reading of sociolinguistic hierarchies might please you, Julia. It's bluntly anthropological.
They have a code, of course, which is all about where you went to school. The upper classes have this code because it's tribal, and everything that human beings do is tribal. So it doesn't actually matter whether you went to Whatnot Comprehensive, or you went to Eton, you will have a tribal network imprint. I don't think any longer people say, as they would do in sort of Lady Bracknell tones, when you bring a girlfriend or a boyfriend home, do we know her people? I don't know that that happens all that much.
What do they talk about in this quaint, exclusive manner of theirs?
The chaps talk about football. And, of course, they talk about golf, which used to be golf, but I think golf's gone off. My grandmother always used to refer to laundry as opposed to laundry. I rather like off, actually. But then everybody talks about golf, whether you live in Sheffield or you live in Sandringham. It's just you belong to different clubs. So if you are a Rotarian in Sheffield, you're slightly unlikely to play at Swindley Forest. And most people who actually do belong to Swindley Forest say, oh, it's so marvellous, because you know when you play golf there, you can take the dogs as well.
Let's not get into the animals aspects. Let's just keep to the human pedigrees. Born into it, right? Education. First it's the prep school, then the public school. What do they do after finishing school?
They don't go to finishing school any longer. That's all over. They do go to university, and they read binge drinking just like everybody else. So that's, and they party very hard. Party, 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 party.
The upper echelons are beginning to sound rather disconcertingly like everybody else. What's the point of an aristocracy if all they can perform are lowest common denominator antics? At least they have better names than the rest of the nation.
The age of the double-barreled name is really rather faded. I mean, you think of Ranulph, Thistleton, Wickham, Fiennes, but he sort of seems to have come down to Ran Fiennes. I don't think it's very smart to be triple or double-barreled. Isabella Anstruther Gough Calthorpe, who is a girlfriend of Prince William and is an actress, I mean, she calls herself Isabella Calthorpe. The new aristocrats, if you might call them that, shed those trappings very quickly.
But isn't the whole class thing based on a conceit elaborated over millennia, a hierarchy of prestige with the royal family at the very apex?
It's interesting about the royal family. There was a huge controversy at the time of the wedding of Prince of Wales to Diana Spencer, saying that she was much grander than the royal family, which indeed she was. Much better lineage, much better breeding. Don't forget, the royal family are hugely compromised by having German ancestry. It's not a good look. And Prince Charles practically comes up with knee height or grasshopper. The Queen, of course, bless her. I mean, we never want her to die, and we think she's absolutely wonderful and couldn't be better in any possible way. But she's stocky little Hanoverian.
Yep, goodbye, goodbye. Sorry, yes, I was just bidding farewell there to Victoria Mather's chances of getting a damehood any time soon. But just who are the elite of the elite? Who within the top ranks actually are the arbiters of taste and standards of speech?
Who are the arbiters of taste? But I think we all do hop back a bit to Nancy Mitford and P.G. Wodehouse, because it was such a golden age of tribalism. And what you said more about you than cash ever could. So you could be really poor and shabby chic, but you could still have immaculate breeding. And also you could be rude in a much better way.
Victoria Mather mentioned just there the blessed P.G. Wodehouse. And when I played Jeeves in the television series of Jeeves and Wooster many years ago, there was some concern about getting the character's accents correct. No matter that the actor who played Bertie, I forget his name just at the moment, but I think he's some sort of musician or hospital porter. Anyway, him, you know who I mean. He had, as it happens, been to Eton College. But despite Hugh's authentic Etonian upbringing, there were grumbly letters to the papers accusing him of sounding suburban. Penny Dyer is one of the current top voice coaches. She's worked on films such as The Queen, TV series like Downton Abbey, and works regularly in London theatres. How does she go about coaching today's actors to reproduce the authentic upper-class accent from the past, or even in the present?
I don't think you can call it one voice because there are so many different levels of standard English. And so there's different levels of TOF. And if you listen to the modern prestigious received pronunciation, you'd be listening to people like William and Harry, wouldn't you? And if you listen to William and Harry, they give you different versions of TOF. You can still hear this sort of very dark sound often. You often, that feeling of space inside the mouth, which sort of says something about size of space in which they've possibly grown up in. The more up the social ranks you went, the more likely you were to actually grow up in a house that was large. And if you grow up somewhere which is large with a lot of land around it, then your voice learns how to fill that space.
Now there's an intriguing insight that the sound of the voice possibly owes something to the physical conditions under which it was produced. And they were used to issuing orders to the servants, of course, so those imperious tones came as a result of the silver spoon in their mouths.
In the 20s and 30s, there were certain sounds which you absolutely don't hear today. One of them is absolutely. You know, the fact that one had much more of that black cat that sat on the mat, having a nap, has flat, flappy ears. So that would be one of the classic sounds that you'd start to find, which is that it's not an ah, it's an eh. People spoke in those days by much more withholding the emotion in, not expressing through the emotion, expressing much more through the consonants, which gave you the sense of what you were hearing. So you would also say to them, don't forget to keep the Y's a little shorter. So you spring off the Y's, lovely, city, it's a pretty and ugly city. They spoke in statements. They often would ask a question as if they didn't expect an answer. Or in fact, they already knew the answer. They're just being polite by asking it. So the inflection would often go down. So did you have a good holiday? I know you had a good holiday, but I'm going to ask you anyway. And you'd certainly have to slap down the rising inflection. And you'd be saying to them, don't forget, of course, in those days, they use their L's and they use more T because the T is like an emotional weapon. It's very useful. Sometimes it's good to say you're late and sometimes it's good to say you're late. Certainly in those days, they wouldn't have said you're late. That would be too modern.
But even in the 20s and 30s, the barriers could be modishly porous.
I mean, it used to be the East End and the West End, didn't it? And one would ate the other, and hence why Gel went from being Gel down the East End to Gel in the West End. And they sort of dropped it and picked it up and picked it up and dropped it, depending on what was fashionable. Now, it's more fashionable to talk down, to sound cool, to drop our T's, to generally let the vowel sounds slop around in the bottom of our pants. There's always been a hierarchy of accents, but that becomes more and more a thing of the past as accents actually begin to, in some respects, not in all respects, homogenise and come together, you know, as communication leaps around so quickly. Because language is shifting so fast, I would say finding the sound of 50 years ago seems more like finding a sound of 100 years ago these days.
Perhaps the trouble with this old debate is that these issues always seem to be ventilated in a metropolitan context. They take on a very different hue if seen from elsewhere. Yorkshireman Ian McMillan, born just a year or so after the famous you and non-you argument, is well known to radio listeners as a poet, presenter of The Verb on Radio 3, and a panellist on programmes like Just a Minute. He also wrote a guide to his native Yorkshire dialect called Chelp and Chunter.
It's Chelp and Chunter.
How much does Ian think our attitudes towards class and language have changed in that time? And what about place as a factor?
I think over my lifetime, there's been a gradual erosion of the purity of the language where I live. I'm 55 years old, and I think that over the last 30 years, there's been a dilution of it. A lot of the villages near me were pit villages, were simply places that had their own space and their own language. So that in certain parts of Doncaster, an old pushbike was called a grod. Language didn't move very far. And there was always the idea that somebody who spoke like me, you felt that when you opened your mouth, standing behind you was everybody who had ever talked like you. And that was all right. There was a huge queue of them behind you, and you felt kind of safe in that. But then on the other hand, at school, Mrs. Yelland, one of my teachers, we were talking about birds. I referred to the word shep. I said, there's a shep. And she said, even Mr. Yelland sometimes says shep. She said, but you mean a starling, don't you? And I said, yes. And she said, you must say starling, because shep is the wrong word. I said, but it is a shep. She went, yes, but it's a starling. And that was so interesting. Mrs. Yelland, who spoke a bit like when Molly Sugden used to pretend to be posh. It was a bit like that. You suddenly realised that there was another code out there that you had to use if you were going to get anywhere.
Better speech, or what was understood as better speech in those days, was seen as a way to a better life. Just 40 or 50 years ago, that sense of superiority and inferiority was still indissolubly linked with how you sounded.
We had a careers thing at school, and it was that one, just like something out of Kez, where they go, oh, you're a clever lad, you can go down to the pit officers rather than going down the pit, but you must learn to speak properly. And in the 60s in Barnsley, elocution teachers made quite a good living. They took people away. A friend of mine got taken to elocution lessons, and he came back speaking this very clipped, strange thing when his man was in the room. When his man went out, he spoke like us. And he ended up working in a glider factory. And I thought, isn't that interesting? There's the height of something. Somehow, in my poetic way, I thought, his language soars. His language soars like the gliders he makes. And I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think it's only in the last 4 or 5 years, I think, that I've been able to say the word lunch without inverted commas. And whenever I say it, still, there's still a little flat-capped man on my shoulder who says, who the hell do you think you are? Who do you think you are saying lunch? I still think that the word lunch can't be said with the kind of use that I say. It's kind of lunch. I can't say it's lunch. You can't say it. You get lunch. I'm going for lunch. You sound like an Alan Bennett character, don't you? Going, I'm going for lunch. I find myself saying, at lunchtime, to my wife, I think we'll have a bit of something. Neither of us can bring ourselves to say the word lunch. And we kind of say it and we go, lunch. And it's so interesting, that, isn't it? That I think that it's still a posh thing to say. And when people say, we're having our supper, I agree with Stuart McConey on this. He says when he's invited round for supper, he thinks you're going to have some chips on a tray in front of the telly. Whereas some people have their supper when I have my tea. and they have their lunch when I have my dinner, and people think I'm putting this on, that it's not true, that I'm living in some kind of Ilkhamobartat fantasy, but I'm not. I really am not.
If the way we talk is so central to our own sense of who we are, then to make a profound change to our speech can be interpreted as a profound betrayal of our roots and of our very selves. But today, as everything is so mobile, where do you look to for authenticity?
Well, of course, looking back, the authentic voice was given to you by the place you lived, by the shape of the landscape, by the industries that you worked in, or your father worked in, or your mother worked in. And now with that having gone, it is harder, I guess, to find a linguistic identity. But it hangs on. It really does hang on. I'm lucky enough to visit a lot of village halls. I do village hall performances. And there in the depths of Lincolnshire, or in Norfolk, or in Suffolk, or in Worcestershire, you still hear the accent, the language, the twang. It's not really... I think maybe what it is that we can choose to use it if we want. We can be our own elocutionalist. The young people of today will think that if I can speak in the way they speak on the television, in the way the newsreader speaks, then that'll mean that I'm kind of prosperous, that I can be in an office and won't be laughed at, that I can ask for a ticket on a train and people won't know instantly what my dad does for a living. So there's that odd thing that you want to see yourself as being somehow, you're doing all right. And if you're doing all right, then that's reflected in this kind of locutions that you use, I think. I began on local radio back in the 80s, and it was interesting that my voice was like this. And I would get letters. I got a man accosted me on the street in Barnsley, and he said, "They can't talk like that on wireless." And I said, "But I'm talking like thee." He said, "Yeah, but they can't do it on wireless." And he said, "That's not that long ago. That's the late 80s.
Did he say wireless? That's an old you word, isn't it? Yet it sounds perfectly authentic in this context. And that simply is the key. Authenticity. Appropriateness. If it sounds right, it is right.
And I speak like this, and I'm on Radio 3, and I'm on Radio 4, and I'm on Radio 2. And that has to be a good thing, that people like me and people like Andy Kershaw can be on Radio 3. That's a good thing. But I still, my friend said to me, his friend's mother said to him, "He puts it on, you know. He doesn't talk like that in the house." The people assume that in the house I talk like Prince Charles. But I think what would be more interesting is if in the house Prince Charles talked like me.
Fry's English Tonight was presented by Stephen Fry. The producer was Ian Garthouse. It was a testbed production for BBC Radio 4. That was the last in the series.